So thank you for the introduction, and I thank the program committee for giving me the opportunity to give this talk on output bandwidth effects in seated FELs. My co-authors are Greg Penn and Sasha Zolens from Berkeley, and also we've been collaborating with a number of people from Synchrotron Trieste on the Fermi project, some of whose results I'll be showing during this talk. So you've heard, I think, a fair amount about harmonic cascade and seated FELs, and you know, when we were younger and first heard from Li Wayu and others about this approach, we thought this was really wondrous stuff, and you could get very, very pure output. For those of you who are baby boomers, some of you may remember this famous Ivory Snow box top that had Marilyn Chambers on it. And the reason we thought seated FELs could be extremely good for experiments is essentially you would start with nearly complete longitudinal and transverse coherence, and the belief was this coherence would stay during passage through the various undulators in a harmonic cascade. And ideally, you could reach an output bandwidth that essentially would be transform limited, and at XUV and shorter wavelengths, this is the inverse bandwidths can be very, very large. At 10 nanometers for a 1 picosecond pulse length, you could get 10 to the 5th inverse bandwidths, and at 1 nanometer, 10 to the 6th. And you should compare this to SASE, which for most devices where the row parameter is of order 10 to the minus 3, the predicted bandwidths are of order, inverse bandwidths are of order 1,000 or 2,000. And you heard from Mikhail Yurkov on Monday that right now this number is of order 100 for the flash facility, although that's due to a large energy sweep. So as Giovanni Danino also told us on Monday, that the feeling was you could essentially map from a pure seed coming into the cascade chain to nearly as pure output. And also, more importantly, besides the question of bandwidth, is it was thought that the output wavelength would be very, very insensitive to things like jitter on the electron beam energy. Again, there'd be a direct map. Essentially, the wavelength out would be some harmonic of the wavelength in. And also, within the electron beam pulse itself, you could have, a relatively soft limit on the gamma variation. Basically, from steady-state simulation, you're allowed a gamma variation, which could either be one-half, 1 over 2 NW, or the FEL rho parameter over 2, whichever one is the largest here. Well, things really aren't so nice when you get into the details, and I think a number of us are much older and perhaps wiser now, and after seeing Bill Coulson's slides, I certainly know a lot of us are a lot older. And things are not as pure as you thought. This is a famous movie for those of you who are boomers. And the less than perfect reality is there are many, many effects that can increase the bandwidth of a seated pulse, at least especially in a harmonic cascade. It's very, very difficult to get close to the transform limit. And the rest of this talk is going to be talking about some of these things that essentially show how the E-beam can take a nearly perfect input seed and turn it into some very degraded output pulse that can have a depressingly large bandwidth relative to the theoretical transform limit. So why are we interested in getting very, very narrow bandwidths? Over the past year in the Fermi project, I've learned about something called RICS, which stands for Resonant Inelastic X-ray Scattering. And this is a very hot topic amongst scientists who study electronic structure issues in the soft X-ray regime. And basically, one does what's called multidimensional spectroscopy. You're looking at inelastic X-ray scattering where you essentially come in with an instant energy photon of energy, in this case, capital omega. That then gets inelastically scattered, so you lose a little bit of energy, and essentially you map the cross-section sense of the energy loss versus the input energy. And in order to do this, you have to have a very, very pure pulse because the elastic cross-section tends to be much, much larger than the inelastic cross-section by order of 10 to the 5th. So essentially, in order to prevent contamination in the experiment from elastic scattered photons, you have to have a very pure input beam, which you can either achieve with a monochromator upstream of your experimental sample, or, and this is what we were hoping for, the Fermi project and future FEOs, you could come in with such an extremely pure narrow bandwidth source that you wouldn't need a monochromator. And again, because of this 10 to the fifth difference here, you actually need a lot better than 99.44% pure. So a narrow bandwidth is actually insufficient in the sense of just the RMS bandwidth. You also have to limit any pedestal underlying the bulk of the photons in the region of this incident energy omega. Because of this 10 to the fifth ratio, even a pedestal which is down by more than a factor of 1,000 can essentially give you more elastic scattered photons than you would have inelastic scattered. Whoops. So at Trieste, a proposed experiment on the second FEO, FEO2, would be studying RICS. This is due to an MIT collaboration. And what they would like is basically a continuously tunable output source from the FEL. You know, that we believe we can do in terms of as long as the input seed is tunable. Downstream of the sample, they want to essentially use a very narrow monochromator to define essentially the energy difference, that capital omega minus minus omega. Okay, and then the hope was initially when we began studying Fermi, that the input source from the FEO would be so pure a narrow band of order 1 millivolt type width, which is about 10 to the fifth resolution at 10 nanometers, that you would not need this monochromator. And the reason that's attractive is monochromators essentially have an inefficiency. You lose wanted photons in the various optics, both matching into the monochromator, within the monochromator itself, and matching out. And the efficiency is generally much less than 20%. It can be down to 5%. So if you can avoid, you know, losing that factor of 5 to 20, you do obviously much, much better in your experiment. Let me just quickly go over the questions of what bandwidths are important. If all you're interested in is essentially looking at the post-monochromator flux on a sample, essentially a one-dimensional study, all you really need to do is maximize your dp d omega at the wanted photon energy. And generally, any underlying pedestal or even the RMS delta omega is unimportant as long as this is a sufficiently large number. Now, for RICS, we're two-dimensional. We both need this in the sense of the input photon, but we also downstream are putting another monochromator. So again, spectral resolution is key, and you have to be very, very careful with pedestals. Now, of the various sources we considered for contamination, the spontaneous emission does not appear to be that much of a difficulty. You can show that the number of photons per electron that's in effectively the same transverse mode as the FEL is about 2 alpha photons, where alpha is the fine structure constant. For the Fermi FEL, 1 at 800 amp current and an output, the shortest output wavelength is 40 nanometers. That's only of order 400 watts. Now, given we want to produce of order 2 gigawatts, that's more than a factor of 10 to the 6. So from the issue of spontaneous emission, we don't think there's a contamination problem. SASE emission, however, can be more of an issue. You generally have a narrow output bandwidth of order rho, which for the Fermi designs is a couple times 10 to the minus 3. More importantly, the output angle of SASE is basically going to be similar to the output angle of the amplified seed. And the worst case in sense of SASE growth is if your final radiator is many exponential gain lengths long, that if you come in with essentially low bunching at the final harmonic, you have to, in order to reach saturation, you have to go many gain lengths. So just from a scaling argument, the ratio of SASE power at the output of the final radiator relative to the amplified seed is going to scale as the input noise in the gain bandwidth at the entrance to the final radiator divided by the coherent microbunching, essentially the microbunching produced by the upstream modulator, this ratio squared. Now, in general, we're talking about coherent microbunching after a modulator of order of a few percent or less. Okay, the noise power scales, or noise bunching scales inversely with the current. There's a factor of C missing in the denominator here. And rho comes in because you're worried about the amount of bunching within the gain bandpass. For Fermi, this noise level at 40 nanometers is of order 2 times 10 to the minus 5. So if you take this ratio, you can see potentially the SASE to seed, amplified seed power exceeds 10 to the minus 5 at 10 nanometers if your coherent microbunching is below 1%. So this says basically you have to be very, very careful with designs that, let's say, only get up to one part in 10 to the 3, even though that's much larger than the noise microbunching. You'll still dominate the noise, but you're going to create SASE contamination, which is much larger than 10 to the minus 5. So just looking at how you calculate bandwidth for a output Gaussian pulse with no noise on it, the uncertainty principle basically gives you in the intensity domain the RMS bandwidth times the pulse duration is 1/2 for a fully coherent pulse. And in terms of energy, I couldn't find H-bar under Windows, that's 0.3 MeV per inverse picosecond. Okay, so again, for the 1 picosecond pulse, potentially you can get transform limits below 1 millivolt, which people doing RICs would like. Now, if on top of that Gaussian pulse you have either amplitude or phase variations or both, you're going to have contamination and the bandwidth will increase. If it's a simple amplitude variation with no associated phase variations, that amplitude variation is small, epsilon much less than 1, at some constant angular frequency. You can show the output power is essentially in two sidebands, each side of the central frequency in scales like epsilon squared. Now, for a 1% amplitude variation, which really is amazingly small if you think of most start-to-end simulations, this increases the background by a few times 10 to the minus 5. So you can see, again, it's going to be very difficult to keep things down to the 10 to the minus 5 level. If you have a simple sinusoidal phase variation, again with the maximum amplitude being epsilon much less than 1, you get a series of sidebands, each one of which whose power scales like the Bessel function squared, where n is the harmonic number, and you find that again generally the first sideband to either side is the most important, scales like epsilon squared over 4. In terms of increasing the bandwidth, when this product on the left is equal to your nominal bandwidth for a pure Gaussian, your RMS bandwidth will increase by square root of 2. It's not very hard to make these two equal. For a phase noise on the output, only a tenth of a radian, and that's very, very small. And if you have essentially 16 oscillations over your picosecond pulse length, these two numbers are equal, which means you're going to miss the transform limit by at least square root of 2. So now I'm going to give some numerical examples from the Fermi study that we and collaborators at Trieste and MIT have finished. For FEL1, the nominal design is beam energy 1.2 GeV, 800 amps, relatively small emittance given the wavelengths we're interested in. And the expected output nominally is 2 gigawatts from steady state simulation. And what's important is something to consider. From steady-state oscillations, we believe the acceptable bandwidth in input energy is of order 0.4%. That is, the power doesn't vary by more than a factor of 2 if you stay within this essentially energy bandwidth, which at that energy is plus or minus 5 in gamma. Now, FEL1 is a simple one-stage, it's not really a cascade, being one stage, where the input seed energy modulates the electron beam and the modulator. You go through a chromatic chicane, which converts that energy modulation into strong microbunching. And then you radiate at a harmonic in a final radiator, which is for FEL1 is of order 15 to 20 meters. And generally, we're picking harmonic numbers that range from 3 to 6. Now, for an example, I've picked what is called the M1 for medium pulse distribution number one produced by the start-to-end team for Fermi. This is the current right there. You see it's very, very flat, other than a tail current spike that's fairly large. The energy variation, again, falls well within this plus or minus 5 in gamma. So nominally, you would hope you would have quite nice output. You plot the average power over this pulse versus Z. We actually saturate after about 15 or 16 meters, and I think it's about 2.9 gigawatts. If you look at the output power versus time, it's not completely flat, but you generally have of order 5% oscillations. One thing that's a little bit interesting is you notice how the head portion of the pulse has much lower energy than the tail portion, and that ratio is much greater than the variation in current. And as you see, things are very symmetric here. So this was at least initially a little bit of a surprise. Now, if you look at the output spectrum, basically, if it were transform limited, you would just have one, essentially, spike. It's probably hard to see in the audience, but essentially, it'd be one histogram bin here. Instead, it's much, much wider. So this was, for at least some of us, initially a bit of a surprise. Now, I then did another simulation, which by mistake basically took the input distribution, which is produced by Elegant, and essentially flattened out this energy variation there. Essentially, I set a flag in the ginger code incorrectly, which essentially just used a constant input gamma. Okay, then when I ran that, you get about the same power out. In this case, it's, I think, slightly above 3 gigawatts. It's hard for me to see from the side here. The output power versus time is now much flatter. There's still a dependence here, but you could attribute that just to the fact there's about a 10% variation in current. If you look at the output bandwidth, now we have a nearly monochromatic output. Okay? So what's happened is this energy variation, the true energy variation, somehow has really degraded your input seed or your output seed or your output amplified seed bandwidth, even though you're well within this constraint of plus or minus 0.4%. Now, if you look some more at the output, it's clear what's going on. Okay, I think a label is supposed to appear. It didn't appear. This is the iconal phase, essentially the slowly varying phase plotted versus time. Now, for the true energy variation, you see there's a very strong quadratic component. And the scale here is 4 radians from that, it's actually 8 radians from that point to right there. So this is a strong variation. And you can see it essentially looks like the inverse of this energy variation coming in. For the case where I zero out the energy, there's just a simple linear change in phase, and that's attributed basically to the slight change in refractive index due to the current variation there. So why does this essentially quadratic chirp match into such a strong phase variation? It's very obvious once you think of the design of most harmonic cascades. You have a very strong chicane following that modulator. That chicane not only gives you strong microbunching at essentially the wanted frequency, but it also compresses the pulse or expands it depending upon what your underlying slow variation in energy is. And essentially your compression factor is going to scale as the instantaneous time derivative. We've replaced T with Z in this slide. It scales with dZ. It also scales with the R56, essentially the amount of dispersion in your chicane. So for the cases I just showed where essentially you have a positive second derivative of the underlying energy, essentially the tail part of the pulse is trying to rush towards the middle. So essentially you compress more here, so you're blue shifted. The head is moving away from the center, so you're red shifted. And basically a quadratic chirp leads to a linear chirp in microbunching wavelength. Essentially, you're taking the first derivative here. If you just have... Okay, thank you. Somehow this isn't the latest version of this talk. So this also explains why the head portion, because it's redshifted, doesn't match well to the essentially the energy of the beam. Essentially, you've got a mismatch in resonance energy, where in the tail you're well matched. And that's why for you have much less output in the head portion than in the tail portion. Now, this effect, in terms of the general rules, was studied and predicted by people at Argonne and Brookhaven a number of years ago. But they were using it in order to change, essentially to allow you to tune the output wavelength for a constant wavelength input C. In this case, it's really killing the bandwidth. So looking analytically at what happens if you essentially parameterize an output quadratic chirp in phase with this parameter zeta, basically your output bandwidth compared to the transform limit will scale like 1 plus zeta squared to the 1/2. Okay, so when zeta is large, this really hurts you. For that previous example I gave, analytically the zeta is predicted to be 13, and that's about the ratio here from 1300 to the transform limit of 2300 in sense of the inverse bandwidth. Okay, there's an additional effect that degrades it a little bit, which I'll talk about, but it's approximately the right scaling. Now, in order to keep zeta squared, zeta beneath 1 for this example I just gave, 40 nanometer output, you would have to have over the limit your quadratic chirp over your pulse to 7 parts in 10 to the minus 5. That is very difficult to do for most accelerator design. Okay, now the other thing to notice is zeta scales like tau squared, where this is your length of your e-beam pulse. So delta omega scales like tau for zeta large. This means actually your bandwidth gets worse for longer pulses if you have a constant quadratic chirp. Okay, and which is sort of the exact opposite of what you'd like. We were thinking, okay, we want 1 or 2 picoseconds to get down to millivolts. In fact, with a quadratic chirp, it would make our bandwidth worse. So the question is, how do you deal with this change? How do you essentially limit zeta? And there are two things you can do. You can either keep R5-6 very small, or you can limit your maximum chirp. Okay. Using a very small R5-6 is not very attractive. As Li Wai-Yu showed in his paper, the amount of bunching you have coming into your radiator scales as an exponential, a small R5-6 helps you there, but it kills you in terms of the Bessel function. Okay, and in general, for his approach, which is high gain, where you pick an imposed energy modulation close to the coherent modulation, this would say you would want an R5-6 of order 400 microns. It's actually 600. Again, this slide did not get updated. Okay, which is much larger than we're using, which is 24. Okay, and our low-gain approach, where essentially we use very strong bunching so that the term here is much greater than delta gamma times d theta d gamma is greater than 1, you want 65 microns or less. Okay, so my present feeling right now is if you have a design where you're going for very high gain, where you're limiting the amount of imposed energy modulation in your modulator, it's going to be very, very difficult to achieve a narrow bandwidth if that's one of your goals, unless essentially you eliminate this gamma prime term, double prime term. Okay, now how well can we do in eliminating gamma prime? The start-to-end group for the Fermi study came up with a clever idea. Essentially, Max Kornacki and team and Simone Dimitri will talk more about this later this morning. Said, let's do reverse tracking with the Lee track code. These are your wanted conditions at the end of the accelerator, flat energy, a relatively flat current. Okay, you reverse track. Okay, but in this case, there are no longitudinal space charge or CSR effects. You find what you want coming out of the accelerator is basically a flat, a linear chirp in energy and also a linear chirp in current. This seems to be obtainable. Okay, so running Astra and GPT, basically you can produce a pulse that looks like this. The ideal is linear, but this is good enough. The wake field, fortunately, is linear enough that you essentially can do a map from this to that. So how well can they actually do? Here's a case where they've done reverse tracking. This is the so-called L4 because it's a long pulse, and basically they've applied these methods. CSR is turned on, but not longitudinal space charge effects. What you find is the main bulk of the pulse is very flat in energy in sense of sort of coarse, very coarse grain. Also, the current is quite flat. So this is good news. However, you sort of ask, is this pure enough? You notice these oscillations here. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Okay, if you then run this through similar thing through FEL1, here's a case where we didn't apply the reverse track. Here's a case where we did. The current profiles are similar. You still have current spikes, but the output spectra are very, very different. In the case where you leave that chirp in, you're very degraded. There are sort of the two bluish lines here. When you look at the M6 case where you've eliminated, more or less eliminated that chirp, you're about 2 or 4 times above the transform limit, so much better than before. Okay. So let's briefly talk about 10 nanometer results. Okay, and just the fresh bunch where essentially we seed the initial part, the tail region of the pulse, and then we delay it through the second through a delay section, and it radiates at 10 nanometers from the head portion. Okay, essentially one finds the exact same behavior. If you leave in a quadratic chirp, you're quite degraded in your output, whereas if you eliminate that quadratic chirp, just leaving a little bit of a cubic term, you do much better. And even at 10 nanometers, we're getting bandwidths of 10 millivolts or less. And this is the iconal face here, and it's relatively flat over where the pulse is. So, and let me skip that. We still have these oscillations right here. It's not 99.4% pure. Right now, we believe our limits in terms of our final bandwidth are set by these oscillations. These are relatively fast compared to the whole pulse, but they're still slow compared to the amount of slippage you have. So the slippage will not wash these out. Okay, and because the delta omega, essentially, there's a very fast phase changes, so you're going to increase the bandwidth. Unfortunately, it's very hard to compute what is the this is LSC. What is the level of the longitudinal space charge? Right now, we have a large effort at Berkeley trying to apply some new tools to compute this accurately. We still don't have a final answer, but hope to within a year. Unlike the slow chirp, where ideally you could put on a counteracting chirp on the input seed, you're not going to basically be able to use your seed, essentially manipulate your seed to eliminate these effects. These are stochastic. They'll change from shot to shot. They also degrade, essentially, your coarse-grained phase space, so that they're not going, you're really increasing the effectively the emittance of your output pulse. So in order to control these, we believe we're going to have to use a fairly strong laser heater. This may present problems for the fresh bunch or for the whole bunch approach, but I won't get into that. So, in summary, there are various things that essentially prevent you from getting a purely transform-limited pulse. In terms of contamination, SASE can be an issue if you're not if you're relying on a lot of exponential gain in your final radiator. We believe right now the worst effect is leaving a quadratic energy chirp on the E-beam, which this generally comes from Wakefield's in the accelerator. You know, you have to use a fairly strong dispersion section in order for a cascade to work. The limits on the second derivative gain are very, very small, but you have some hope of both through reverse tracking and possibly putting a reverse chirp on the input seed to cancel this out. You're left with these fine scale variations, and at the moment, the only solution, we believe, is putting a fairly strong laser heater on to increase the incoherent energy spread. And I think since my time's up, I should end. I'd like to thank my collaborators, various institutions, and this has been quite a learning experience.
So. Thank you very much. Open to the floor for questions, please.
You have discussed in detail, I mean, this is really very beautiful work, these effects for the high harmonic, high gain generation case. Now, there is another possible approach to obtain small bandwidths, which is the cell-seeded scheme. Would you have the same kind of problems? Could you compare the two from the point of view of the final bandwidth?
Okay. That's a good point. I think in the self-seeding scheme, where essentially you're using a monochromator on SASE light to define a narrow seed, as long as you, you know, ideally you shouldn't have to put in any chicane or dispersion section in the system. So that should avoid this particular problem in sense of chirps. And in that case, you would essentially be sensitive to just what I would call steady state effects, where if you have a variation in current or also a variation in energy, it's just your gain varies, so you're not, your output pulse is probably not going to be as wide as your input electron beam pulse. But there you're probably talking of factors of 1.5 or 2 below the transform limit, ideally. As long, okay, with, again, a caveat, if you do have lots and lots of exponential gain, that might be a factor of 2 or 3 rather than 1.5. But right now, I don't know of an effect that would lead to factors of 10 or 20. So in that sense, the self-seeding scheme, even though, as we've discussed privately, you need a lot of undulator following that monochromator, might be much more immune to this disease than is the cascade approach.
Thank you. Any further questions? There, one at the back there, at the back. Dave.
In addition to changing or adding some curvature to the energy spectrum of the electron beam, have you considered any second order dispersion corrections like the what we normally would call T566 correction in the chicane?
Let me defer to people more expert than me. Ask that question to Simone Dimitri later this morning. You know, they're using Elegant to do these calculations. Presumably Elegant includes those terms, but I myself don't use Elegant, so I can't comment.
One further quick question, thanks.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand why you couldn't pre-compensate at least somewhat with the seed, because isn't
okay.
The curvatures...
If the curvature is utterly repeatable shot to shot, which it should be as long as your current is repeatable, which it should be, then the question is how, in the temporal domain, how much jitter is there between your seed laser and your electron beam? Because when, essentially, if you offset, you essentially are left with, you're still left with a linear offset of your final wavelength. So essentially you have output wavelength jitter. It's still bandwidth limited. But if it's jumping around by 20 MeV, it really doesn't help you that much if it's one, you know, millivolt wide. So it right now for Fermi, we're thinking it's going to be difficult to get temporal synchronization below 100 femtoseconds, at least this year. I mean, people are clever. Maybe in 2 years they'll be down to 50 femtoseconds or less. But that's the remaining issue. If as long as the chirp is repeatable, then you have to worry about essentially synchronization.
Okay, if we could thank our speaker again, please. No time for any further questions.